before we get to the podcast, I wanted to invite you to the Pipeline Conference. The theme of this year's conference will be succession at every level. The event will be held October 11 through 13 here in Nashville, Tennessee. The focus of this event will be succession all the way from senior leadership at a church to the preschool and even the parking volunteers. That means that this conference is for your whole leadership team and any volunteers who you'd like to join you. Our speakers will include John Piper, Bob Russell, H.B. Charles, Tom Rayner, and more. Again, this event is October 11 through 13 here in Nashville. We will have separate coaching days on October 11 and 13, with the main event being the 12th. These days provide your team a chance to get focused, engaged training from our team. We have early bird discounts running through July 31st, so there's still time to take advantage of these, along with our fantastic group rates if you want to bring your team. Go to myleadershippipeline.com to learn more about the event and to register your team. Again, that's myleadershippipeline.com, and don't forget to take advantage of our early bird and group discounts before July 31st. Hey, and welcome to the Five Leadership Questions podcast. I'm your host, Barnabas Piper. I will be joined in just a moment by my co-host, Todd Adkins. Today, we have the privilege of sitting down with Dr. Henry Cloud. I don't think Dr. Cloud probably needs much of an introduction. You have probably run across one of his many books or various other resources. His best-selling book, I believe, is the book Boundaries. It's sort of a staple book on relational boundaries. What is healthy? How are they important? Why do they matter? Coworker relationships, marriage relationships, parenting relationships. I'm actually reading it right now and finding it very, very helpful. One of his most recent books is The Power of the Other. We talk about that a little bit in the podcast. You'll hear about that. He even digs into the neuroscience aspect of things. And the reason that he writes so much about the relational side of things, and this is a leadership podcast, and you kind of might be going, "What? How do these things fit?" is that he's a clinical psychologist. So he works with people in therapy, in psychological therapy, but he mostly works with leaders because one of the things that, and he describes this, is that he has seen the need for counseling, for therapy, for the psychological side of things to be worked out for people in leadership. So we even get into, are leaders more prone to, you know, psychological issues of various kinds? And he has a really interesting answer to that as well. To learn more about Dr. Cloud, you can just go to drcloud.com. That's drcloud.com, not the full word doctor, but drcloud.com. And you can see there that he has resources on leadership, on parenting, on marriage, on conflict resolution, just a full spate of relational issues. So books, blogs, videos, the whole gamut. So again, that's drcloud.com, and you can go there. You're very much going to enjoy this conversation. He's an engaging person, really good insights, and just he's very eloquent. And so I think you will get a lot out of this personally for your own life, your own decision making, and your own processing of things, as well as in your organization where you are in leadership. Thanks so much for listening. Now enjoy the conversation with Dr. Henry Cloud. We are here today with Henry Cloud. As you heard in the intro, he's an author, he's a speaker, he's a lot of things and well known, and you probably already heard of him. And we're really excited to have this conversation. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Cloud. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Hey, it's good to be with you guys too.
Before we dive into our typical five questions, we usually want to give our guests a chance to kind of introduce themselves, because an intro is, you know, people can find that stuff online. It just, it's not really who you are. So we'd love to give you a chance to just tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are, a little bit about your background, your family, the things that, that make you who you are kind of outside of the bullet points.
The easiest way to understand my path is that I'm a little different in this space in that I'm a clinical psychologist. And I was trained in the areas of clinical work that people did back then. You know, it's before all the coaching and leadership wave that we saw come later. But my first job happened to be in a leadership consulting firm. And they wanted a clinician because, you know, psychologists deal with people basically in three areas, you know, how they're functioning emotionally, you know, the stress and the burnout and the anxieties and the fears and the addictions and all that stuff. And leaders do have those, by the way. Mm-hmm. And second area is the interpersonal side. You know, a lot of times we would get boards or CEOs that would refer key reports, or leaders that had great business skills or organizational skills. And yet there was some interpersonal kind of dynamic. They were too controlling, or they, you know, did all sorts of stuff that make people crazy and screwed up teams and all that. So that was kind of in my world. And then the third one is performance. You know, how do you find your gifts and talents and make them, you know, fruitful in the end? And so I went knocking on doors for a job as a psychologist, and my first job was in that leadership consulting firm. So I kind of became the leader shrink, if you will. And for you know, a handful of years, there were probably 5 or 6 years where that I spent 100% of my time just sitting and listening to leaders. And in that time, I began to see something that I think really formed the path from then on, was that, you know, dividing leadership up into two disciplines. Like, you know, on one side, you got the leadership stuff like vision casting and being a change agent, building critical mass and all of those great topics on one side. But then leaders learn all those and they go to the workshops and they go to do all that. But then they have to go out into this weird place called reality. And they find out that they're the ones that have to pull it off. And that, you know, there's some personal growth that has to occur in, you know, what if you got to go cast a vision, you got a little self-doubt, or you got a critical voice in your head and you think, who's going to listen to me? Or you've learned to think defensively and you don't think expansively, and you're thinking 1x plus instead of 10x. And so there were a lot of things I began to see that leadership was not only about leadership, but it really was about a personal journey where leaders had unresolved developmental issues that held them back. They had interpersonal issues. They had performance issues. So I just fell in love with the field of leadership. I did my doctoral dissertation as a clinician in leadership personality. And so basically, since I started, I've worked with leaders. And then I started a company. I wanted to do a faith-based psychiatric hospital and treatment center. And I went out and raised the money and all that kind of stuff, and did one, and that worked, and then did another one, and that worked, and ended up with in about 40 markets in the Western United States with hospital units and treatment centers. And I ran that company for about 10 or 12 years, and learned a lot about leadership from the inside. So I was listening to leaders, and then I actually had to, you know, be one. And then when healthcare started to change with managed care and all that, I sold that company and went back full time as a practitioner, because I just loved working with leaders. So since basically the late 90s, what I've done is I've had a boutique practice where I work with CEOs and executive teams, and then build programs for companies in that kind of span of leadership, what leadership requires from the technical side, but also in developing the people. So that's my little corner of the world, and that's kind of how I got here. I'm a little different in this space in that, you know, when people say, well, you're a writer and a speaker, I'm really not. I'm a practitioner. You know, I spend
like practitioners here.
I spend 100 days or so a year literally locked in war rooms with CEOs and leaders.
And that's, I imagine that's why, well, I have two thoughts from listening to what you said. The first is that, being a clinician and then just loving, you know, sort of caring for leaders puts you in a unique space, because the world has plenty of leadership strategy books, and the care of leaders is an entirely different arena, but people resonate with what you write and what you say. And I think that has to be because you're a practitioner, because you're bringing to bear a conversation you had last Wednesday, not just sort of a paradigm or something.
It's really hard to write crappy platitudes if you got to go out in the, real world to make that stuff work. So I'm not that smart. I just spend a lot of time working with people, and you start to see the real issues. You know, you start to see the things that leaders actually struggle with and the things that hold organizations back and the steps that they actually can make and do make every day to get to the next level. And I never feel like I go to work. I mean, I get to go watch great leaders and just see what these people do. It's so incredible. So I love coming at it from the practitioner side. And I you know, if people say, well, when do you think you'll retire? I don't really know what that would look like. I just love working on it.
Well, I'm not going to ditch the first question, Barnabas, but I have been dying ever since I knew we were going to have this podcast when we had it scheduled. I am so excited to ask this question. Is there a relationship between leadership and mental illness? We read constantly here, and anything that comes out on leadership, I'm obviously really interested in. But there was a book probably about 5 years ago, Nasir, is it Gami? First Rate Madness. But it was really uncovering links between leadership and mental illness. And I really resonated with that book.
Well, I hadn't read the book, but let me approach it this way. When you say, is there a connection? I think what you're saying is we see sometimes, you know, great leaders that have really, you know, a basket full of screwed upness, right?
Yes.
And so what happens a lot of times is, you know, you'll take somebody, I've written about this in The Power of the Other. I've actually got a chapter that says, you know, something like, it's not true that healthy guys finish last or healthy people finish last. But what happens is you've got to realize that there is a correlation sometimes between, you can link, in other words, that you can see that certain people with certain kinds of traits and qualities will be found in a group of high performers. Okay. You hear this about narcissism, for example, and a lot of narcissistic leaders. Well, if you look at narcissism, you know, one of the things in there is you'll see a sense of grandiosity. Okay, well, grandiosity means that somebody thinks really big and expansive and I'm the center of the universe and I can do anything and all that kind of stuff. And they'll also be very aggressively driven towards those ends. Now, there's an illness aspect to, let's just take, you know, Tom and Joey. If Tom is a narcissistic personality, but he also has drive and he's a big, expansive thinker and he's charming, which a lot of narcissists are, then it's not the narcissism that makes for the leadership. It's the aggression and the drive and the ability to, you know, move people along and charm them and all of that, which you could also find those traits in very healthy leaders that do grandiose things, but they don't do it to serve themselves. And they're very aggressive, but they don't do it manipulatively or in controlling ways or domineering ways or toxic ways that end up hurting a lot of people. So if you know, I'll hear that the big example we would hear a few years ago is, what about Steve Jobs? You know, you say people have to be healthy and relational and all this. He was a jerk. And people say I said, exactly. Let's take Steve Jobs. Do you think that Apple could be built by any jerk or any control freak or anybody that screamed at people? Is that what built Apple? What built Apple was his creativity, his ability to, you know, influence people into going in a direction, his energy and his devotion and his focus. Now, that's what built Apple. Now, you add to that all of the stuff that y'all are talking about, those who bring up his name, of the downside, controlling, and then you say that's what made him great. Actually, it's the opposite. It was the aggression and the creativity and the drive that made him great. The other stuff, actually, in my view, I would say, where would Apple be if he weren't that way? Where would Apple be if he didn't get fired and have to drop out of it for 8 years or however long that was. Mm-hmm. Where would it be if he hadn't have shut down people's brains at times because he was screaming at them? Where would it be if key people hadn't have left? Because so what they'll do is it's a normal human thing to make a correlation. For example, a correlation is the murder rate in New York City is highly correlated with ice cream consumption. The more ice cream people eat, the more people go kill people.
Is that true?
That's just true.
But see, that's a fun fact.
People take a correlation and then they assume causality.
I'm feeling triggered right now.
Exactly. So what happens is we know that murder rates go up when it's hot, right?
Mm-hmm.
they just do. And so people also eat more ice cream when it's hot. But you can't take a correlation because Lincoln was depressed. He was basically, you know, his big thing was all that depression and stuff. That's not what made Lincoln great. So you got to be careful about all of that. Now, here's the other thing I would say. Don't be surprised when you find leaders are unhealthy in some ways, because that's why I said earlier, my focus is on this middle space between leadership and the personal and interpersonal development of humans. And you're going to find people that are really good leaders, but they're also have some areas where they're screwed up. And that's always going to have collateral damage and collateral effects. And as people begin to work on those issues, then that's when things really, really, really get to where they could get. And we know that people function better in emotionally healthy environments.
Okay. Well, I am very excited also to ask our first question, which is, who are you learning from?
Oh, gosh. Currently, you know, historically, it's been so many different people. I think that's the most important thing that anybody tries to do anything can focus on. Because basically, you know, we come into this planet with two things only. We come in, we're given time and energy. And how you invest basically those two things, the time that you have and the energy of your heart, mind, soul, and strength, your talents, where you invest those things is basically the result you're going to get. And so what I find is the greatest leaders I know are the most curious, and they invest time and energy in learning. And so I think it's one of the most important things. And you know, historically for me, I've learned from basically three or four sources. One is I'm a big, 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 big reader. And I read a lot of technical stuff. I've probably got, you know, four or five books a week that I'm diving into. It's just what I love. I've always done that. But secondly, I've always been fortunate enough, and I don't think I did this as a strategy. I just think that God blessed me with this, that there were people further down the road that made themselves available. And, you know, call it mentoring or coaching or kicking the butt or whatever it was, just always had this kind of little handful of people that were older than me and kind of had been there and just coached me along the way. And then the third thing I think is we learn from the actual doing. That's kind of the getting out of the boat, and you want to learn to walk on the water where you can't do it from inside the boat, right? And so currently, if I answered that question, I think I'm basically right now, I've been learning a lot I've been on a trek in the last probably handful of years, 4 or 5 years, deep into neuroscience. And when you begin to understand the way that people accomplish goals and accomplish visions and all of that, and you learn how much of it really comes from how healthy what's going on in their head is, and you learn, you know, drives that in teams, what kind of interactions cause, if you have a team meeting, what kind of interactions can a leader have that'll cause that team to leave the room and go conquer the world, or cause that team to leave the room and their performance go down. That's really, really, really powerful stuff. So
what in that neuroscience sphere, you're talking about like the science of the brain. So Todd, as a leader, directs a meeting and the team leaves and is either motivated or demotivated. And that's something scientific, is what you're saying, like something that happens in the brain to...
We can hook people's brains up and measure it.
And what are some of the findings there? That's really, really interesting. What are some of the things that you've seen in terms of what triggers what?
Well, let me do a little bit of a plug for a book here or two. I wrote about this pretty specifically in a book called The Power of the Other that came out last year. Mm-hmm. And basically the premise of that book is, when you say the power of the other, when Todd is in that room leading, he is an other to those people, right? And so he's doing a bunch of stuff that science would show us. One is the emotional climate that he's creating in that room is going to activate, if it's positive. Now, I don't mean you don't talk about negative stuff, but I mean if it's positive in terms of, you know, the way they're connecting, the way they're motivating, how free they feel to express themselves, how challenged they get, which is an arousal state. We only learn when we're aroused, how much of a push he's giving them in a non-toxic way. When you create a positive emotional climate in an organization or in a team or even in a one-on-one, what we notice in the brain is that the chemicals that fire creativity, problem solving, perseverance, emotional regulation versus stalling out, clarity versus confusion, goal orientation, movement towards goals, all of those functions run on a set of neurotransmitters. And certain kinds of interactions, like I was talking about, drive those neurotransmitters. On the other hand, if he gets in there and he's toxic or he's disengaged or he just talks about happy things and doesn't push people and he doesn't keep people awake and challenge them and he doesn't build connection within the team, or he has some kind of fear-based thing going on, or the wrong kind of fear, because fear is good, but the wrong kind of fear or control, mm-hmm. any of those dynamics, then what you're going to see is you're going to see a decrease in the brain functioning of the people in the room and a minimalization of those good, you know, biochemical interactions. And you're going to see an increase in other kinds of brain systems and hormones, which basically trigger, you've all heard this, the fight or flight syndrome. Mm-hmm. And when that part of the brain gets triggered by a leader, your people do one of three things. They fight, they flight, or they freeze. And so fighting means they're going to resist you either openly or passively. They're going to go out the meeting after the meeting at the water cooler and resist everything you said, or they're going to resist it internally. Secondly, they're going to flight. They disengage in some way, or they're sending their resumes out, or they're going to, you know, involve themselves in other things other than giving you their time and energy, or they freeze. And so this stuff is so important that, you know, I don't want to date this podcast, but, you know, look back to the Super Bowl this year when you got a team that's down, 28-3? There's something that happened at halftime.
Yeah.
It's, you know, some stuff went on in those conversations to come back and win that really got those brains going. And so it's hugely important.
And just to be clear, that was not a passive aggressive shot at Todd's leadership of meetings. That was just painting a picture. So no offense, Todd.
I asked that you were talking about how awesome they were.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. That's the other
one. The awesome side there.
Right.
I was totally on that.
Todd, have you ever been in a Barnabas meeting? It's tough.
lots of fighting, flighting, and freezing.
Yeah. I
thought you and Barnabas may have colluded
after that.
I thought you all colluded before the podcast, because basically when you talked about curiosity being the number one thing that a leader needed, he just dropped a book this year on very recently on curiosity. So,
oh, cool. What is the book?
It's called The Curious Christian, and it is about It's about how curiosity is sort of a driving force in faith, in relationships, in work, in leadership, just sort of sort of this vital foundation for us as followers of Christ.
That is so cool. When, you know, curiosity is, and it's so interesting because when you find curious people, what you find is something that's so, and this is where you get an intersection of really spiritual maturity a lot of times with leadership, but there's two, you know, there's a bunch of factors that really drive this curiosity, but two of them that are really important, I think that people need to do in their leadership circles are, one of them is the absence of self-centered judgment. You know, what we know about curious people versus people that stall out, people that stall out basically interpret every event. They're asking the question, what does this say about me? Am I good or bad? So if something works out, then they go, great, I'm doing great. And they feel good about themselves. If something doesn't work out, then they feel I'm stupid. I'm a loser. You know, I can never do this. Versus the curious person, if something works out, they don't think about it in terms of themselves. They look at it and go, why did that work? What did we do here that we can multiply? You know, what were the key elements? How can we make it better? And they go on this question seeking, and it's not really about self-judgment or validation. And when they lead others, they're not judging people about whether those people are good and bad. They get curious about, I wonder why this guy's not doing well, or I wonder why she's not reaching her potential. They're not judging, they're curious. And when they're negotiating, they're curious to find out, what does the other person need? You know, how can we meet? And all of that kind of curiosity. And then the second factor is basically humility. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I look at the phrase you use, curious Christian, unfortunately, so many times that's such an oxymoron in evangelicalism. Because it's hard to find sometimes in certain circles, it's hard to find a Christian that's curious about anything because we act like sometimes we have all the answers and actually we don't. And if you go through the scriptures, what you find is that the ones that thought they knew it all and thought that they were right were the ones that were missing it the most, all the way to the people that knew everything about.
Let's just camp on that right there.
They knew everything about the Bible, and they missed the incarnate word when he showed up.
Yep. Yeah, I think it seems to me that the know-it-all factor, that pride aspect, and then the fear aspect of curiosity will lead us places we shouldn't go, or kind of the two big inhibitions that stop Christians. And as much as I would love to camp out on this and passively promote my own work and talk curiosity because I love it.
It's not that passive to me, but go ahead.
That's true. It wasn't passive. Todd set it up and we're just taking a swing at it. But we should probably move on to our second question because we still have a few to get through. So redirecting the conversation a little bit, what is the main point of emphasis for your leadership right now? Either leading a team, leading the people who you are working with as a clinician, or for yourself as a leader?
Probably the main emphasis right now is I'm in a little bit of a season where, you know, for a number of years I've worked with leaders in organizations and companies, and I would do, develop leadership development programs that they would use in-house that sometimes would go company-wide to, you know, tens of thousands of employees. And then what started to get really interesting, you know, a handful of, call it 4 or 5 years ago, when we really got to the point where streamable and downloadable stuff could really be usable and scaled. Now, I know it's been around a little longer than that, but when you're talking about, you know, people actually living on a platform together and being able to do leadership development together and assignments and videos and find it wherever they are and pull it out of their pocket, I started to think, you know, instead of having to be in a particular organization to teach this stuff and take people down a developmental path, I got the vision for making a leadership university that was digital, that companies could use and churches could use. And about 3 years ago, started a company that's basically taking on all of that content and leadership development programs and turning it into a leadership university that companies buy and the churches buy and take their people through. And so my big leadership emphasis in that is one of the things I strongly believe in is you got to figure out your role. You got to figure out what you bring to the party and what you don't. And you've got to find the people that do. And so my big leadership emphasis in building this, if you go to drcloud.com, you'll see a site that has all sorts of stuff on it. What I define my role is, look, I'm really about the content and the message and kind of the platform delivery of that. But I needed to put a team together of people that could actually build that out and scale it. And so my big emphasis has been to deliver the content to that team. And Jennifer Lane is the president of that company, and she's really driven the talent side of that. And so now we've got just the best people all around the country. It's a real virtual team, and we've built web architecture. All sorts of production stuff. And so that's kind of where I focus.
Moving from being a content creator, platforming, I want to be careful with the word platforming. That means a thing in the digital sphere, but being the voice of the content, how did you?
Two things it means. I mean, one is the literal, ones and zeros. We had to build a very complicated, web architecture mm-hmm. to have a platform that could do all of that. But the other side of platform is basically, if you're going to talk to people, you got to have some people out there, right? So right. You do have to kind of focus on how do we build a critical mass of people that want to learn together and want to join in and curate material and curate practices. And so that's kind of the other use of platform.
And then the other part of the question that I was wondering about is how did you find the team? I mean, because you said they're nationwide, you have a specific kind of voice message content. So I'm just curious, building a team across the country, there's just some practicalities to that I think our listeners have benefit from hearing. How did you go about building this team to help create this digital learning platform?
Well, I wouldn't love to take full credit for it because then I'd have to, somebody want me to do it again. but what I did was, and I think this is key. I think that, that you've got to find if somebody's a pastor, for example, or somebody's a CEO, what they've got to find around them are people that can actually build teams because the number one person they got to build a team, but they got to have people that can build teams. Because if you're going to grow something, you've got to have leaders that you're working with and developing. So the first thing I did was I knew that I didn't want to run the company in the operational, the strategy, all of that stuff. So when I found the person that I thought would do exactly what it needed, and my big role was to help develop her as Jennifer and actually resource her and turn her loose. And she can, and one of the reasons I chose her is she came from a big platform development side of the world, which was she had been both in business, but she had been really, really experienced in building platforms. She launched stuff for Timex. She launched, the Samsung Galaxy thing. She had launched a bunch of stuff, and she knew all the technology side of that. She knew all the branding side. She knew all of that, and she was also, in that space, the younger space than I am, of the look and the feel and the way that people consume stuff now. So my basic role is find the right person, resource them, and let them go. Mm-hmm. And based on her experience in networks, you know, she went out and found the digital architecture people that do Jimmy Fallon's site and do Tesla's site and, you know, just real experts in all these different spaces and brought them together. And she's just done an incredible job.
So let's move on to question three. What are two or three things that you absolutely must do every day to continue to lead well, other than read your Bible and spend time practicing spiritual disciplines? What are two or three things?
Well, it's interesting when you say that. The first one has got to be, you've got to stay connected. And I don't know how to overemphasize that, but when you really get it, that you're not the creator, you're a creation. And so you're not self-sustaining. And so you've got to stay connected to the key fueling sources and people that you need to fuel as well. And so the two or three things that I try to do every day is I make sure that I connect with those who, you know, personally are the most important to me, but also to drive whatever I'm driving, you know, you got to stay connected to them. And so that's the first one that I got to do every day. The second one is, and I'm not putting these necessarily past that one in any particular order, but the second one is, I think you have to really be cognizant every single day, is what I'm about to do going to move anything forward? Because what happens is we get lost in activity, and we can be busy and we can do a bunch of stuff, but you've got to ask yourself, it really, you know, is this moving anything forward? I've only got so many minutes during the day. Is this really moving anything forward? And it's a practice. I think when you learn that, you find yourself all of a sudden there's some stuff that just really, why am I doing this? And so I think that's a part of it. And for me, I've got to be every day. Somehow I've got to be gaining new information. I've got to read every day. I just have to. And it's so, so important. And then the fourth one is, I think I've got to get off my butt and go do what I'm learning that gets me out over my skis and challenges me a little bit, because you're only going to learn through experience. And so people that sit on a rock and just consume all this stuff, but they never get out there and fail and get stretched and go have a difficult conversation that they've been afraid to have, or go launch something or try something or sell something, you know, every day we got to do those things.
We would say that it's really a combination of knowledge, experience, and coaching that ultimately leads to transformation in someone's life. It's one thing to just train somebody, but it's quite another to develop their competency in a particular area. So I love that whole idea.
Can I interject something a little bit there?
Yes.
To the experience part, you know, there are a lot of people that are gaining experience every day, but they're not really gaining experience. What they're doing is they're experiencing the same thing over and over and over. And that's really not development. You know, once you've done something enough, what happens is that gets translated into the brain into known neural pathways that it's like riding a bicycle. You don't really need to gain experience riding a bicycle every day. What you got to do is take the experience that you've learned riding a bicycle and go jump out on a single track mountain that would be gaining experience. So you've got to be, you know, when you look at that challenge ability quotient, where you've got to be challenged past your current abilities and you've got to grow your abilities to the new challenge, that's when you get development.
No, that makes a ton of sense. I mean, just couching experience and expanding that more than just sort of redundancy and doing the same things repeatedly. For the sake of time, I am going to move us on to our fourth question. we could spend a lot of time on all these questions. We always have this tension with guests just because there's so many good things to talk about, but I'm going to move us along. The fourth question is, what does leadership in your home look like?
That's a great question. That's such a great question. Because I find a lot of people, both men and women, you know, they're good at work and they kind of like get confused at home. And I go, listen, you know, this thing doesn't change. Basically, my model of leadership that I talk about in Base Leadership University on is leadership is basically, I think it's five buckets. The first one is you got to see, you know, there's a desired future state. There's a vision. And then you got to engage the talent. And then you got to execute some sort of a strategy and a plan. And then you got to hold people accountable and measure the right things. And then based on what you're finding when you hold people accountable, you got to fix what you find and adapt and solve that, right? So I listen to people that are great leaders at work and they go, well, how do I lead at home? I go, dude, it's just like you do. What do you do at work? You bring people in a room, you have a meeting and say, yeah, I'm going to translate this to home, right? So I do this with my family. Okay, guys, it's summer, all right? When we get to September, what do we want to look back on this summer and say, that was awesome? What will this summer have looked like? Let's create a vision for what we want to have this summer. And so if we figure, you know, we want to have some great experience or we want to do this or whatever, then you engage the talent. Okay, what's everybody's role going to be in building that vision? Or we'll do this around a vacation, or we'll do this around Christmas, or we'll do this. You know, you've got to sit down and say, where are we headed? What's important to us? And then secondly, what's everybody's role? Okay, we said we're going to plan this great trip. We're going to go to Japan or something. Okay, so mom is really awesome at doing the research and finding the places and knowing what's cool and has a network of people to do that. I'm good at something else. The kids are good at something else. And so you engage the talent and then you got a plan, you got a strategy, and everybody does those. We're going to get together next week. We're going to come back and see if everybody did what they did. And it's the same thing about all aspects of the family. You know, if we're going to be close, we got to have a vision of what that looks like. And that means everybody's going to come to the dinner table and we're going to do our plan. We're going to talk about our day. And we're going to, if you try to squirrel out on that, we're going to hold you accountable. It's no different in the home. It's just that people don't take the great leadership qualities and practices that they have at the office and they don't take them home. And if you would do that, leadership's about taking from somebody from here to there. If you would do that, you could take your family or your marriage or any of it from here to there. If you defined where you wanted it to go and you got the talent bought into that, and then you execute a plan and devote resources and time and energy to it, you'll get there.
How do you keep home from feeling corporate? In, you know, because home is a very relational place, and the workplace is often, you know, it's much more agenda driven. So how do you take the principles of leadership that work at the office and bring them home without losing that relational context?
Well, first of all, I would want everybody to challenge that split. You know, to think that work is about work and home's about relationship is one of the problems. The people that don't do well at work are the ones that don't make it relational enough, if they look at it that way. They don't realize that relationship fuels work, A. And B, you go home, and if home isn't working, then the relationships suck. And so there's no happy home where everybody's not engaged in fulfilling, you know, kind of being fruitful. And so I like to think about, you know, let's get back to a faith perspective here. What you see in the Bible is the way that God created humans, and God is a lover and he's a worker. You know, God in his home, in his relationship, in this Trinity, what they did was, hey guys, let's do something. Let us make man in our image. Okay, let's create this big universe. Let's do all this stuff and let's be engaged and let's have goals and let's share those goals and let's work, you know, with doing that. And that's a really vibrant home. On the second part of that, though, is you don't want home to look like a factory that's churning out, you know, key performance indicators all the time and a P&L. But what you want it to be fun. And in every family, you know, we got to get stuff done. But gosh, if we're not having fun and hanging out and, you know, being squirrely and playing games and all that, then that's not even a good company, much less a house.
Well, and in the example you gave, you know, vacation to Japan or wherever, the idea is to go have a great time together. And that's sort of the end game. And so everybody playing a role sets up the great time.
Exactly. Exactly. How do you have a great time if you just go over there and go, so now what are we going to do? You know,
right.
It's both. It's always both. You know, how many marriages break up because somebody's not doing the work of the marriage? And how many marriages break up because they only do the work of the marriage, but they're not very connected, very relational, and very, you know, chemically exciting to each other. So it's always, always both.
Okay, let's move on to our last question. And that is, what would you tell your 20-year-old self about preparing to lead?
Well, you know, this is really, it's really interesting because when I look back at my 20-year-old self, what I wasn't smart enough to tell my 20-year-old self what God actually made my 20-year-old self do. And that is when I was 20, I got really, really depressed. I'd lost a life goal. I went to, you know, college as an athlete and had an injury and didn't, you know, get to fulfill that or pursue it. Found myself really, really depressed. And I was in such brokenness and need that I had to seek help. And God just put people around me that built me, you know, from rubble, really, and mentors and people that adopted me and loved me and challenged me and confronted me and made me change and gave me called out gifts and told me I was crummy at other things and you ought to do this. And so I would tell my 20-year-old self, you know, you should get on your knees and thank God that he's putting people around you that will help develop you. And I was just fortunate enough in my brokenness that I didn't have a choice. And I would tell somebody that is 20, best thing you can do is to, you know, is to need other people that can help you. And then the other thing I would tell my 20-year-old self that it took me a while to learn was you just can't do everything. And I think learning focus earlier would have been helpful to me. And I just had to learn that over time.
But I suppose not knowing it at 20 is part, I mean, it's part of the learning process, though, trying things and discovering what you're not good at.
Yeah, and part of it is I'd tell 20-year-olds, whatever's making you comfortable, get out of it. if you think about it, you're only going to get better by being uncomfortable, yeah. Right? And basically, if you like what you've achieved at 20 and you're comfortable, well, then fine, retire. But my hunch is you don't.
Well, and you'll stagnate. And so even if you do like it, it's you've hit a ceiling. All right. Well, let's land this. Dr. Cloud, thank you so much for joining us. It has been a pleasure, and as I'm sure it will be beneficial to our listeners. So thank you for your time.
It's been fun to be with you guys. I love what you do. Keep it up.
And for listeners, you can learn more by if you go to drcloud.com, that's drcloud, so the abbreviation for drcloud.com, you can find resources, points of emphasis, blog posts. There's just a wealth of resources there covering some of what we've talked about and a whole lot more. For the show notes, you go to lifeway.com/leadership. We will have those there. So quotes, links to resources, so you can find it all there. Again, that's lifeway.com/leadership. We really appreciate you listening. We haven't asked this in a while. If you would jump on iTunes, leave us a rating and review. That helps other leaders like yourself find the podcast. So if you haven't done that, we would be honored that if you took the time to do that. Thanks so much for listening, and tune in next time. Thank you for listening to the 5 Leadership Questions podcast. Don't forget to visit myleadershippipeline.com to learn more about our fall conference, October 11 through 13 here in Nashville, and to take advantage of our early bird and group discounts. Again, that's myleadershippipeline.com, and the early bird deadline is July 31st, so move quickly to take advantage of these discounts.